from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll have a look at a new book celebrating the history of Crown Hill Cemetery.
I'll get a preview of the production of The Tempest in White River State Park.
And I'll get the scoop on a new study by the Arts Council of Indianapolis of the arts community. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. For generations, Crown Hill Cemetery has represented both an elegant, eternal home and a beautiful park for the living of Indianapolis. This year, Crown Hill celebrates its 150th anniversary, and Sharon Gamble invited its president, Keith Norwalk, in to talk about its place in history and about a coffee table book commemorating the anniversary.
So, special anniversary this year.
Yes, our 150th anniversary.
150th, yeah. And while we're going to spend the most of today talking about the gorgeous, and I mean, I cannot, I'm sorry this is radio, so we can't show the pictures. This book is not only beautifully written, but is a spectacular photo essay of Crown Hill Cemetery. But I want people to know that you have all kinds of activities. You have tours, you have talks, and all sorts of things going on all the time, not just in an anniversary year.
That's correct. And I think the book very clearly shows just the diversity of the events and the marvelous history. And but it's a very special place, and I think that many in the community feel that same way.
We're sitting at WFYI having this conversation, and I know for a fact that a number of people at WFYI for years have brought a brown bag lunch or stopped to pick up lunch and gone over to Crown Hill to eat it because it's just so spectacular. So so just kind of some big picture questions here. Crown Hill benefits from being built up and enlarged during a period that's kind of like the City Beautiful movement, if people know about that, where cemeteries were, well, I'll let you describe, meant to be not just a place where you go to mourn, but
absolutely
something beyond that.
Crown Hill is a very good example of the American rural cemetery movement, which started in the mid-1800s. And it was a time where there were not city parks, and it served that purpose. People would come out to the cemetery, and I think many of us recall our grandparents still going to the cemetery on Sunday afternoon. Mm-hmm. So that tradition is actually rooted back in the American rural cemetery movement. And we believe that that purpose still is served by Crown Hill Cemetery. It's a place for people to enjoy the green space, passive recreation, as well as reflecting and spending time in a very quiet, very serene environment.
Now, before Indianapolis had Crown Hill, its original cemetery was in the heart of what we think of downtown now.
Correct. Greenlawn Cemetery actually was located on the corner of West Street and Kentucky Avenue. And that cemetery began in the mid-1850s and within several decades was completely filled. And it was at that point that the city elders looked to property farther out from the city. And Crown Hill has served the community for over 150 years.
And I'm always floored by the vision of the folks who chose the current location, because the city itself was still contained to just a little bit beyond the Mile Square. I mean, I live at 31st and Delaware, which was billed as Indianapolis' first suburb when it was platted in 1904. And this was a few decades before that. So,
yes.
So why go so far out? I mean, it's like they had a crystal ball to know
It's a great question. This was at a time where city cemeteries were very quickly filling. It was during the Industrial Revolution where factories were very much in abundance in the urban areas. And there was a desire to locate Crown Hill Cemetery in a location where it would never be filled and where it would serve the community for many, many decades.
Many, many years later. And as I understand it from the book, the gentleman who owned the acres was a little reluctant to sell them.
Yes, that's correct. It had a great history back in its original time. It was a tree nursery and very bucolic, beautiful space, very natural, very remote. And there was a great deal of controversy as to why it was built so far from the city. Hmm. And today we find it's in the middle of the city.
Funny how things change. So throughout its history, Crown Hill has had corporators. What is a corporator?
A corporator is a more or less a board member, and the original board of corporators were 30 civic leaders that really designed the purpose of the cemetery, and that tradition, that particular board, continues with us today. It's changed tremendously, and today we feel that it certainly represents the constituency of Crown Hill Cemetery.
Sure, which has always been very diverse, and we're going to get back to that in a second. But just looking at the book includes a list of the corporators over the years, and just looking at it, that list is kind of like a history lesson in who has shaped this city and who has donated time and talent and treasure as well to build the city that we know.
Very definitely. The original city leaders, you see their heritage through every generation. And today we have a whole new group of leadership within our city. And we feel that support and that recognition is very helpful.
Now, Crown Hill, and this, I don't know if this is typical for large cemeteries. Of course, Crown Hill is atypical, isn't it? Is it the third largest?
Third largest single location cemetery in the country.
Wow. But it has had people of all cultural backgrounds buried in it pretty much since the beginning. Is that typical, or was that something our city did a little differently?
That's a great question. It is somewhat atypical. I think that we're very fortunate that we truly represent the socioeconomic and cultural development of the city. And that's one of the things that makes it so rich today, that you can trace our heritage culturally. And it's just a tremendously diverse, which obviously gives us a great deal of education as to how our city developed.
Absolutely. And not just people of different skin colors and different faiths. I was fascinated by the first Jewish person to be buried in Crown Hill. And there had been a very well-established Jewish cemetery on the south side. And that was so interesting that this person's family wanted them at Crown Hill. But also socioeconomic differences. There used to be homes for women without resources, and a number of their folk are buried at Crown Hill, orphans.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Very, very fascinating part of our history. In the late 1800s, there were numerous groups. There were some religious groups that had space available for their church members. But the socioeconomics are fascinating. We actually have a section that contains over 600 orphans. And it's fascinating to see the recognition that some of these real milestones have for the community and for the cemetery. And so groups have come in and looked at how these represent different important components of our history and are recognizing those today.
Speaking of our history, Crown Hill has been especially great about embracing our public servants, both police and firefighters and other locally serving public servants, but also military veterans.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The Heroes of Public Safety section was actually developed in 2001, and it has just grown in an amazing way. Today, we truly have heroes of public safety, and we're very fortunate to be able to recognize them at Crown Hill. And we see that particular section offering a great contribution to the community.
Now, Crown Hill is host to very traditional gravestones, but also all sorts of fascinating family monuments. The one that always makes me smile is the Bain families. Can you describe that?
Yes, that's a remarkable. It's a private family mausoleum, and it's on the crown. And there's a fascinating stained glass window of a leprechaun. And the memorialization is fascinating. And basically, the family designs often the memorial. So we have some very, very touching epitaphs and just meaningful symbols that many times only for the family. And there's so much that can be learned from the way that families memorialize their loved ones.
Speaking of which, let's talk about Albertina Forrest for a moment. She, as I understand it, sometimes causes traffic to screech to a halt.
Yes. just a very, very poignant, beautiful bronze memorial and very majestic. And she died at a very early age, and her husband memorialized her. And it's one of many people's favorite monuments because it does evoke such strong passion and emotion.
And not to get maudlin, but to describe it, the monument looks like a miniature Greek temple with the figure bronze?
Yes.
Of a woman weeping. I mean, she's on her knees weeping.
Yes.
And oh my, if you weren't sad enough about someone's passing to start with, you certainly would be seeing that.
Yes.
Speaking of monuments, so probably one of the most famous residents of Crown Hill is James Whitcomb Riley, and certainly that amazing structure is a symbol of Crown Hill, but it took a little finagling to get to that, right?
Yes, very definitely. There were... actually took over a year after his death to find resolution to where he would end up being buried.
Mm-hmm.
And city elders ultimately prevailed, and it's a beautiful part of the cemetery and certainly speaks to the greatness of the Hoosier poet.
And he used to come there and
exactly.
Wrote about it. And there's a small statue where children still leave pennies
yes.
in his honor.
Yes.
Is that a reference to that campaign to get the gates of Central Library, and he encouraged children to collect pennies? Is that a reference to that?
I think it is.
Yeah.
I have heard that. But today it serves a very practical benefit in that we collect the pennies and turn them over to Riley's Children's Hospital.
Oh, that's lovely. What's your biggest challenge? You've been doing this for how many years?
25 years.
5 years. Happy silver anniversary.
Thank you.
What's your biggest challenge?
I think the biggest challenge is really making an effort to keep the cemetery relevant to our community. It is a museum in terms of our history, but it's also a place that I consider very spiritual and again, very serene. And it just offers so much to the community that through the efforts of the Crown Hill Heritage Foundation, we have events, as you mentioned, tours, over 250 tours annually. It's important for us to bring people to the cemetery. I hear often from parents that it's such a great opportunity to expose their children to not a cemetery being macabre, but a cemetery being potentially very beautiful and very meaningful to the families that it serves.
Sharon Gamble with Keith Norwalk, president of Crown Hill Cemetery. You can purchase the book and learn more about anniversary activities at crownhill.org. Again, crownhill.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Each summer, the Heartland Actors Repertory Theater, or HART, produces a Shakespeare play in the White River State Park. This year, they tackle The Tempest. Travis DiNicola spoke with Diane Timmerman, who's producing the production, and Robert Neal, who plays Prospero.
Diane, Robert, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you two here.
Thanks.
Great to be here. Yeah.
I am so excited. As I just said to you before we went on the air, The Tempest is my absolute favorite Shakespeare piece, and I can't wait to see it done outside and on the White River and with Robert playing Prospero. And how cool is this going to be? How fun.
It's the greatest thing. I mean, it's a perfect play for that venue, I think, with the backdrop and also the fact that it's the 450th birthday year of Shakespeare. It just couldn't be a more exciting thing. It's a perfect play. It's a great cast. And Courtney Sale, who's the Associate Artistic Director at the IRT, is directing it. And it's
awesome. She's so talented.
Yeah. And it's just a great company. We've been having a great time in rehearsals.
Very cool. Very cool. So, Diane, why didn't you guys choose Tempest before? What took so long?
You know, I don't know. But this year when we were searching to celebrate Shakespeare's 450th birthday, we needed something that was all-encompassing. Mm-hmm. And certainly Tempest has something for everyone. It's funny. It's romantic. It's dramatic. Mm-hmm. It's got a big storm. So it seemed like the perfect play. And I'm glad we didn't do it before because this year is the right year for it.
And tell me a bit about the rest of the cast. Of course, Robert's in it. Who else can we look forward to seeing?
Oh, we have all of the usual amazing actor suspects of Indianapolis. We've got Ryan Artsberger, Chuck Goad, Mark Getzinger, Scott Greenwell. Chris Hatch returns to us from out of state.
Ross Purcell and Zoe Turner are new to us. Ross is a just recent graduate from University of Indianapolis, and Zoe... I was going into her senior year of high school, I think, at North Central.
She's up in Fishers.
Oh, sorry, Fishers. Okay. Sorry.
Yes. Very cool.
But they're wonderful.
Adam Crow.
Ben Tebbe.
Phoebe Taylor.
Great.
A lot of
usual suspects.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So, to pull them all together, because Heartland basically does just one play a year. I mean, that's got to be a little tricky to do. I mean, to work it in. I mean, just tell me, Diane.
It's a little tricky. It's a wonderful thing. And what we've done over the past couple of years is we're really trying to build our infrastructure because it's a really big job to get this produced down in the park. And so I think that we're seeing the fruits of everybody's labor this year. It's going to be a great production. We have fabulous designers, technicians, stage management supporting this A cast. And our marvelous director. So I think that we're growing up with the Shakespeare, and I think it's getting easier and easier to do every year. So we'd like to go back to our roots and produce some contemporary theater too.
Sure.
So that's a wish for the upcoming year.
Excellent. Now this year, also in addition to having a great play and great cast and all that, you've also got food trucks and beer and wine and right? I mean, that's a part of it too.
Yeah, it's a really great thing. We've got a wonderful pre-show band. We have Sun King Brewery is a great sponsor again this year, Reddick Hill Winery, and all of the indie food trucks. So people can bring their own picnic baskets and carry in their own beverages if they desire, but they can also purchase them, so it makes it nice.
And it's also, it's free admission, but people can reserve tables, right?
That's right. So everybody can come for free. That's no problem.
Which is awesome.
It's awesome, and the park even has little chairs for everybody for free if they want those. But also we have these wonderful premium seats that are for sale. If you go to our website, www.heartlandactors.com, you can see the Eventbrite site for that. And that allows people to sit at a table if they prefer that to the ground.
Sure.
And you know you've got a great seat. Don't have to fight the crowds.
Yeah. And you've got like, what, 8 tops and 2 tops and
yeah,
stuff
we have,
like
yeah.
that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Very cool. That's great that you're able to offer that. Now, Robert, you got to tell me, this has got to be a fun role for you to prepare for.
It's a great role. It's one of the great
roles.
And
you've not played this before, right?
Actually, I did many, many years ago. I was too young for it, really. Uh-huh. And I've, in all honesty, I kind of forgotten about that, and thankfully, and kind of approached it for new. So, yeah, it's an incredibly challenging part because He makes such leaps of emotional state from the beginning, where he's so bent on revenge and trying to set up this whole thing, and then in the end, the whole play's about forgiveness,
right,
and how one comes to that ability to just forgive someone who's completely wronged you. And we talked about on the first night of rehearsal during the discussion about the play kind of makes you look at yourself and go, who do I need to forgive?
Hmm.
And what grudges am I harboring that I can deal with? The other thing that I find really interesting about it is just the history of the play, because I'm a bit of a nerd about that kind of stuff. But, you know, many people think it's Shakespeare's last play and that it's kind of his swan song to the theater. When you hear some of those speeches, you can certainly hear when he says, I'll drown my book. That he's giving up the theater and going back to Stratford for retirement. And some people even theorize, Trevor Nunn theorized potentially that Shakespeare himself played that part.
I've heard that before. Yeah.
And so I love all of that tradition and history about it. And it's just an amazing, magical play.
It is a magical play,
and it's timeless, and our production is certainly timeless. We're not trying to root it in any kind of Elizabethan world.
That was my next question, to see, you know, what Courtney's take on it was, and what your take. I mean, is this sort of a traditional production? And
We're using Shakespeare's language, of course, but we're not setting it in any sort of Elizabethan. In my mind, it's a kind of a timeless period. Could be any time, and it's this island where anything and everything does happen.
Yeah.
And, like a lot of Shakespeare plays, you know, people are thrust forth from the court into the wilderness to find themselves, and then the play is resolved in the end. And that's really kind of what the journey is for Prospero. But it's and the language, some of the language is the greatest language ever in this play.
Oh, there's so many great speeches and so many quotes that, you know, if you've not read the play before or seen it, you'll immediately recognize. Mm-hmm. And just to give sort of a background for those who may not be completely familiar with The Tempest, I mean, basically starts out with a shipwreck caused by a huge tempest and landing a bunch of people on this island. And Prospero, who you're playing, is this magician who's been living on this island in exile for quite a long time and has been doing some real interesting things on the island with some of the creatures and people on the island and his books and his magic, and from there it goes.
That's right, yeah, and it's from this that he learns about forgiveness, basically, because he creates the storm. He has this chance that the ship is coming by, so he creates a storm with the help of his familiars and so forth to get them on the island. To presumably exact revenge upon them. And then it's through the course of the play that he learns, that maybe that's not the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a parable, but it's not the kind of beat you on the head kind of thing. It's a beautiful human journey that everyone, I think, in life takes.
Yeah, and I was also going to interject. Some of it's really, really funny, too.
It's very funny, too, yeah.
Silly funny.
Very, very funny, which is great. About, I mean, that's Shakespeare, the comedy tragedy mask. He always has comedy in all the tragedies and vice versa, because they heighten one another.
Sure.
And, you know, there's some really profound things in this play. But like Diane said, when you see Trinculo and Stefano and Caliban together, it is hilariously funny.
Now, Caliban's a very interesting character. Who's playing Caliban?
Ryan Artsberger
is
playing Caliban.
Okay, because when you said that Ryan was in the play, my first thought went to, God, I hope he's playing Caliban.
He is, and it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, because he's kind of a nasty little trickster of a character, sometimes very loyal to Prospero, other times less so.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing is that, he helped us survive. I shipwrecked there with my daughter, who was 3 at the time, and now is 15, and he has helped us survive, and yet I've kind of imprisoned him. So it's this weird relationship that we have that through the course of the play.
How cool that this is going to be performed outside. I mean, it's just, you know, a perfect play to be performed outside. And having the White River at your back, I'm hoping that the initial tempest is special effects and not actual. Though that could be very interesting, too, I suppose, you know. But for people who are maybe not familiar with it, the location, there's an area in the White River that's sort of on the, I guess it would be the east side of the bridge that crosses over to the zoo. And there's sort of an amphitheater built there with great stone steps. It's near the NCAA headquarters.
That's exactly right. So the Washington Street Bridge is on one side. Mm-hmm. NIFS and NCAA are on our other side.
Mm-hmm.
And people can park for $5 in the underground parking garage that's right there at the Indiana State Museum in the Idle George. Which is very convenient. You just pop right out and walk over, and there we are.
Very good. And you're suggesting people will come early, right?
I think people should. It's very fun. Mm-hmm. There's bands playing. There's food and drinks. There's a nice atmosphere in the park.
Get there as early as 6 and find a good spot. And
sure, yeah.
Hang out and stuff. And,
yeah.
And then the play starts at 8.
Play starts at 8, and we've got a 2-hour running time, so out by 10.
Good to know. Very good to know. It's just, again, I think this will just be such a lot of fun. But, Diane, as you mentioned, you're looking at doing sort of other things in the future. What is the mission of Heartland Actors Repertory Theater?
Well, I think that that's something that's a work in progress.
Yeah.
Heart was begun many years ago, primarily by Michael Shelton and Ben Tebbe. And at that time, they were really focused on contemporary work. And then as time went on, the Shakespeare project down in White River State Park really took on a life of its own and became the focus, even though Hart still continued to do contemporary work. So I think that we're in the middle of developing our mm-hmm. mission, really. We have one on the website that you can read. But we really want to fulfill a niche in the Indianapolis community.
Mm-hmm.
All of us work at the IRT and the Phoenix Theater, Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, and other places around town. So we don't want to duplicate anything that anybody else is offering.
Right.
And therefore, that's why we've put all our eggs in the Shakespeare basket right now, because that's something we can really – that's a real service to the Indianapolis community to go see a Shakespeare play for free family. You can take your whole family and it's zero.
Yeah. And of course, the White River State Park's been a phenomenal partner for you.
Huge partner for us. Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Because to make it free for all audiences, you must have some pretty great sponsors.
We do. Our three primary sponsors are Lilly Endowment, mm-hmm. Indianapolis, the Central Indiana Community Foundation, and the Crystal DeHaan Family Foundation.
That's awesome.
Those are our three primary sponsors. But other people like the White River State Park, printing partners, everybody pitches in something. Butler University is helping us out. So mm-hmm. we've got a lot of partners.
So, Robert, I'm going to let you have the last word here as the magician. I noticed you're growing your beard out a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm trying to, I can't wait to see you, sort of in this role. What's your costume look like? Physically, you're a very physical actor. I mean, how do you approach this? Because he is this older, character.
Well, he's actually 45. There's clues in the text that tell you that he's 45. I'm 53. And of course, he's been played, like Shakespeare can hold all kinds of things. So he can be played older or whatever. And I'm just sort of playing him roughly my own age. I have a 15-year-old daughter. Miranda's 15 in the play. So mm-hmm. it's very, very close to me. What I'm trying to get right now are those sharp 90-degree turns of emotion that happened, particularly in the latter part of the play. That is, to me, very
challenging. That's maybe the toughest thing, I think, about the play. I mean, reading it or seeing it, some of the characters do just all of a sudden they sort of go from one place to another, and you're like, how did they get there?
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the amazing things about Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. I mean, every Shakespeare character ever written is smarter than us, is more articulate than us, is more passionate than us. They act on impulse way more than we do, and so it's that's why it's so great for actors to play, because it really works your instrument in a way that no other playwright does. And that's what I love the challenge of it. And we have such a great and open company that is just embracing every single aspect of that. And I think when people come and see this, they'll totally understand mm-hmm. what we're saying and what's going on the stage. And they'll be entertained but also moved. They'll leave thinking about their own lives, which is really the essence of all great theater. And I was going to say the fact that it's outdoors and free,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that goes back to Shakespeare himself, or in this country here, Joseph Papp, who started the New York Shakespeare Festival free to everybody based on the you should know this, with the Indy Reads mm-hmm. bookstore, that books and libraries should be free, and he thought Shakespeare should be too.
Free too,
we think that as well, and it is it's an absolutely great thing for this city of Indianapolis.
Tremendous.
To have this going on.
Really cool. Well, Diane and Robert, thank you both so much for coming in Are the Matter today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with Diane Timmerman and Robert Neal. The Heartland Actors Repertory Theater performance will take place July 31st through August 3rd at White River State Park. Festivities begin at 6 p.m. and the performances at 8 p.m. General admission is free, but reserved tables are available at heartlandactors.com, and that's H-E-A-R-T, landactors.com.
Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
Do you realize that this coming weekend is the last weekend in July?
La, 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 la. I don't want to know.
Where did the summer go?
Oh, my gosh. All the back-to-school stuff is out in the stores. But never fear, we have some fun things to do so you can take full advantage of those long summer nights and warm summer days on that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
What do you got?
Well, a lot of fun stuff coming up at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. Including the Animation Day, a film and art-making workshop that they are doing on Sunday, August 3rd, from 1 to 4 p.m. Kids can participate in this as well. And it's just kind of cool. Academy Award nominee for Best Animated Feature, Ernest and Celestine, the person who did that, will be bringing smiles to everyone's faces. And you can find out more about this at the IMA's website. It is recommended for ages 6 and up. For a film and art making workshop at the IMA, next Sunday the 3rd from 1 to 4.
Also at the IMA on Friday, August 1st, as part of the Summer Nights Film Festival, American Graffiti from 1973. Before Star Wars and Indiana Jones, George Lucas wrote this lovely coming-of-age screenplay.
Such a great movie.
It really is. It's a classic, and if you're too young to have seen it, this is a great way to see it, too, on the big screen out of doors. Richard Dreyfuss and Ron Howard, who you may think of as senior elderly actors now, very young in this, and they played best friends and new high school grads who decide to spend one last guy's night reminiscing and thinking about the future before they leave for college. Harrison Ford and Suzanne Summers also appear in American Graffiti. And again, you can see it as part of the IMA Summer Nights Film Festival at, surprise, the Indianapolis Museum of Art.
You know what's the one thing I remember about that film the most?
When I saw it, I was a pretty young kid.
And it was the first time I heard the word puce used in a movie, and it's used to describe the color of the car. And
that's why you have the fashion sense you have. You knew what puce green was when you were just a child.
I remember asking my parents, what's puce? You know? Oh, my. Okay. So, moving on.
Watch for that moment
it's
when you go see the film.
It's a great moment. So, Jazz Fest is coming up, and it's going to be a really, really fun one this year. And
a famous person who you'll know by his hat is one of the headliners.
That's the really cool thing. So, it'll be taking place starting on Thursday, September 11th, and they've just released the 2014 list of artists, including Josh Kaufman of The Voice, which is very awesome that he's going to be singing and performing and doing actually a couple shows at the Marat Theater, which is just going to be awesome, as well as, of course, some great, great local talent. We always love Rob Dixon and the Indianapolis Jazz Collective, plus Steve Turr and Grace Kelly, Tom Harrell, Maceo Parker, a lot of great musicians, actually a total of more than 50 bands over the course of 10 days all around town. Concerts everywhere from down at University of Indianapolis at Crystal Behan, as well as Madam Walker, the Jazz Kitchen Cabaret at the Columbia Club, the Marat Old National Center, Indiana Landmarks, Beer Brewery, the Central Library, Sun King, the IMA, Apparatus. It just goes on and on. Lots of great different events that are be going on over the course of those 10 days. It's going to be a lot of fun. If you can't wait, then maybe you might want to consider coming up on this Sunday, July 27th. You can support Indie Jazz Fest 2014 with the Jazz on Canvas. It's a Jazz Fest benefit, collaborative art show and concert that's going to be featuring five of Indie's best painters and photographers reimagined as inspired musical works. And this is taking place up at the Jazz Kitchen on Sunday. Should be a lot of fun.
Fantastic. Love that. Hey, speaking of festivals, if you've been trying to think of a reason for a road trip, I have one for you. You're going to go all the way down to the Ohio River to Vivi County.
Vivi.
Vivi. I'm sorry, not Vivi County, Vivi the town in Switzerland County. On their first Friday, August 1st, they're doing a festival that includes balloons, bubbles, and bubble gum. It's called Bubblepalooza. I know, and bring your kids, because festivities take place from 6 to 9 in downtown Vivi, which is a charming, amazing, historic little town. Free balloons and bubbles will be available for kids while supplies last at the Visitor's Center on Main Street. And you can win a jar of bubble gum by guessing the number of pieces inside. The exact or closest guest wins all the gum, which is probably enough for a year or until your mother says, stop it. So, also some music going on. The Makeshifts perform 50s rock and roll and rockabilly, and Rhythm and Groove presents Blues by Sandy Pickett and Jill King. So lots going on, a little bit of a road trip, and of course, make a point, you know, maybe stay overnight and just hang out by the river. Beautiful thing to do. At the end of July, the beginning of August.
There you go. I've got another little road trip for you. Go to Fortville and see the 10 West Center for the Arts production of The Nerd, a very, very funny, very funny play, very goofy play, Friday and Saturday nights, this Friday and Saturday night at 7 p.m. at the 10 West Center for the Arts on Church Street in Fortville. Worth checking out. Just hilarity ensues.
Hilarity ensues. There you go. Mm-hmm. Hey, there's some humor on stage at the Phoenix Theater in Miles and Ellie, which is a story about young love, but also about what happens when love takes some wrong turns, and people of all ages can appreciate this gentle comedy. That's on stage at the Phoenix Theater right now, and you can learn a little more at phoenixtheater.org.
Very cool. Last thing I have is, if you're listening to us on Thursday night, then you can tomorrow night, that'd be on Friday the 25th, check out the final concert with the 12 finalists and Michael Feinstein up at the Palladium. This is part of their Great American Songbook Vocal Competition with high school students from all around the country who've been here taking master classes with Michael Feinstein and performing and doing a lot of cool things up at the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel. Well, the final performance with the finalists, 7 o'clock Friday night the 25th, up at the Palladium. You can get more information at thecenterpresents.org.
And we started with the IMA, and I have one more item IMA-related to wrap up our calendar. The IMA is presenting challenges throughout this summer, the Summer Photo Challenge. Every 2 weeks, they're going to announce a new theme, and the theme through August 3rd is portrait. Your job is to take photos that fit the theme and share them on Instagram with hashtag IMA Photo Challenge. Again, hashtag IMA Photo Challenge. Simple rules, just snap a portrait sometime between now and August 3rd and send them that photo and have a good time.
All right. Sharon, we'll be back next week with more things to take photos on that calendar we call.
What'll we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
About every 5 years, the Indianapolis arts community is the subject of an in-depth, comprehensive study to ascertain our patterns as consumers and supporters of the arts. The Arts Council of Indianapolis recently coordinated such a study, and Sharon Gamble invited the ACI's president, Dave Lawrence, and researcher Karen Gentleman of Gentleman McCarty to give us the bird's eye view of the newest study.
Really big picture question here. What changes in the arts and culture scene in our town does this study show since the last major study? And what would you consider the last major study? I'm going to start with Dave.
The last major study that we undertook was basically a five-year study looking at developing the next generation of arts audiences. So 20 to 40-year-olds, young families, professionals, and recent college grads.
Mm-hmm.
And we learned a lot about the need for increased marketing and visibility and some of the ways, sometimes unique ways, that this particular age range prefers to find out about arts and cultural events,
mm-hmm.
And also how they're accessing events and the types of events they enjoy. So I think the some of the changes that we've seen is just an increase in the need for that type of engagement with this demographic. One of the key things, and I know that Karen will get into this a lot, is the need for increased marketing and visibility of the arts. And this just goes across the spectrum. I think when, in between the next audience's study and this one, we had the recession. And certainly had a huge impact on the arts and cultural community, both in terms of the types of programs that are being offered, the way that folks are accessing information, and some just, we think we're seeing some changes in audience patterns, too, in terms of attendance as well. Hmm. So big changes because of the recession.
Karen's been nodding. So what do you have a sense of, were people communicating with you in this study, things like, well, ever since the recession, I'm even more careful about my dollars, so I need more information to make an informed decision, or were they giving you some of their motivation?
Affordability was clearly an issue, and so they are looking for deals. They are looking for things that are free or low-priced, and since I wasn't involved in the previous study, I'm not sure whether that is statistically
a change,
but it certainly is an issue. The study this time around was not just that younger demographic. It was across the board.
Right, it's everyone.
But we were able to cross-tabulate and look at some of the specific things that are happening with the 18 to 34s, and certainly social media has been a change that has helped with the visibility because they are really relying upon that for where they go and what they find out about.
I'm guessing you weren't surprised by this particular wrinkle in the study that people need to be marketed to more heavily.
I don't think it's surprising at all. I think that, especially post-recession, rebuilding those audiences, mm-hmm. And increasing the scope and breadth of the way that folks are attracting audiences to their events is really key. And we all compete not only now just, for arts audiences amongst other arts organizations, but we're competing with the internet and with popular culture and anything and everything. It's about time nowadays and people's allocation of time. So, this just makes the need for marketing and even higher visibility of the arts and cultural community that much more important.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, we heard in the focus groups we did with Indianapolis residents, they'd say, I didn't find out about it until it was over.
Oh.
And you know that there had to have been a barrage of both traditional media and social media to let them know, but people are just so busy. So I think we have to continue to come at them in all different ways.
And speaking as an longtime arts administrator, I'm hearing some of our audience members going, no, we can't afford to do any more marketing, which is where smart a savvy social media person or social media team comes in.
Right.
Yeah. Did any findings surprise you beyond this need to be communicated to even more? Anything else?
The big surprise I had coming in as the researcher was a pleasant one, that we, in terms of the benchmarking we did against five other cities, really came out very, very strong. And those other cities were Charlotte, Cincinnati, Columbus, Louisville, and Nashville. So we had some pretty good competition in terms of their arts communities. And we really found, as many or more of our residents are engaged in our arts on an active level as in those other five cities. And when you look at the Americans for the Arts, where Dave has just been to their convention, their data on the economic impact in Indianapolis of our arts community is just huge. We had, in some cases, twice as many full-time employees in our arts organizations as in several of those other cities.
We should be proud.
We should be very proud. We had $384 million of arts expenditures, which was at the very, very highest end of the six cities. And then there are all kinds of other event-related expenditures that are generated. So we're in pretty good shape. Now, that data, unfortunately, was 2005. So as Dave says, there's been a little bit of an erosion, and we're coming back.
Right, right. What do you find most intriguing from the trends that you identified in this study?
You know, I think sort of back to the marketing and visibility and how people choose to spend their time. You know, I think as I'm sitting here listening to this, something that's really intriguing to me is for so long we've had several, you know, pretty traditional ways of reaching arts audiences. And I think that...
The paper.
Exactly.
And no offense, Indie Star. But.
No. But I think as soon as you try these days to control how people are getting information about the arts is when you begin to really lose. And I think that, you know, the results from the focus groups that people, you know, I think that our arts marketers do a marvelous job. But, you know, you can't really control how people are finding out about information. So we've got to continue to think outside the box. And continue to use social media channels and find non-traditional partners that can help get these messages out, and so that, you know, more people are sort of stumbling across the information in addition to finding it in more traditional routes, which we found are still very important sources of information for finding out what's going on in the community.
So, Dave, can we go back to you mentioned non-traditional partnerships. What's an example of that?
Well, I think that... anything really can be a great example. If you look at some of the things that the arts organizations are doing with bars and restaurants, with retail establishments, with other community organizations, any of these opportunities that allow arts audiences to sort of trip over information about about new and exciting things. Again, trying to look outside of the box, trying to think of ways where, you know, they're already out and about and finding information. A great example of this, I'll give a shout out to Sun King Brewery. They've been doing really great work at promoting arts organizations and arts events at non-arts events. And so, you know, you again just sort of stumble across this information, and it's a great sort of cross-promotional opportunity.
Before we move on, though, I want to mention that I read the white paper for this study, and I feel like it's still important for arts organizations to use the traditional channels, right? I mean, people are still reading their Indianapolis Star, they're reading their Nuvo, they're listening to radio, right?
Absolutely. We can't underestimate the importance of traditional media as a way of getting the arts message out. I think that when we talk outside of the box, we're thinking about enhancements or expansions to this to try to get even more people engaged.
Right. In the focus groups, one of the partnerships that people got most excited about was with arts and sports. And why can't we have more of that kind of married and have sports audiences hearing about the arts? I know our sports corporation just does a lot of that already, but to the greater extent we can do more of that would be super.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that we've had a really strong track record of that with the amateur sports organizations and working very closely with the Sports Corps and even through the work of the Indianapolis Cultural Development Commission with things, you know, arts and fusion events at the World Police and Fire Games and the World Swimming Championships and the upcoming diving trials for the 2016 Olympics. So there's lots of examples of that with the amateur sports opportunities, but perhaps we can branch that even further and look at some new partnerships with Colts and Pacers and other pro teams.
Absolutely.
If you think about it, they're just different ways to spend our leisure time.
Right.
So.
Exactly.
We don't have to put them in totally separate boxes or separate corners. So I know there are some upcoming Arts Council initiatives that are going to address some of what you found out in this study.
Yes, our board worked very quickly on looking at some key themes and ways that we can jump in right away. One of them, in terms of the marketing and audience development and visibility need that we've seen, right after some of this focus group work happened, we launched our Indie Arts Guide, which is the new powerful calendaring and social media and ticket buying and donation platform that folks can find at indieartsguide.org or through our website. And so we're doing, hopefully, a much better job now, and we'll continue to really market and get the word out about that. That's one opportunity. We are going to be embarking on a new arts journalism project. We were one of four cities funded through the National Endowment for the Arts this year on a new program looking at creating mentorship opportunities for university students in some new quarterly inserts in the Indianapolis Star that will have both advertising content as well as stories and articles about the arts and new interest pieces and all of that. So we're hoping that this launches this fall, and this will be another way that we can spark more conversation in and about the arts. So for marketing visibility, we've got all that happening. There's a lot more public art that's coming down the pike this fall. The Arts Council just hired a new public art director, and we're engaging on a new partnership with Keep Indianapolis Beautiful and Indianapolis Downtown Inc. On a program called Vibrant Corridors that's going to bring a whole bunch of new murals, and also with Indiana Department of Transportation, the mayor's office, and Lily Day of Service this fall. So there's a lot more public art coming our way to Indianapolis. And we're also embarking on a lot of arts education initiatives, too. We rely so heavily on so many of our key arts education providers in Indianapolis, such as Arts for Learning and VSA and some other really strong arts organizations that provide arts education programming. But we want to bolster that work. So we're bringing them all together. We're creating new resource pages on our website for teachers and for artists to get involved. And we're embarking, I can't say a lot about it yet, but a really exciting new arts education initiative that, if we're successful, we'll be able to launch in 2015 that could really transform the way that we think about and deliver arts education in our schools.
The area of arts education was probably one of the biggest challenges that was noted in the study. Arts leaders said this is a big deal, that there have been cutbacks in the schools and were concerned about it. The general public said the same thing. 87% of the people we talked to in Indianapolis just at large said children need to be exposed to the arts, and were very disappointed that that's not the case across all districts.
Sharon Gamble with Arts Council of Indianapolis President Dave Lawrence and researcher Karen Gentleman of Gentleman McCarty. Learn lots more about the Indianapolis arts scene at indiearts.org. Again, indiearts.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of an iPhone art show at the JCC.
I'll chat with singer-songwriter Carrie Newcomer about her new book and CD.
And I'll talk with pianist and indie native Rich Glazier about his new CD. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.